from the very responsibility that they should be exercising as elected officials.
The government shutdown continues, and since it began, President Trump has spent nearly 2 weeks away from Washington.
For Friday, October 31st, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The shutdown is growing more painful, with many workers missing paychecks.
That includes the majority of National Guard members.
This is a disservice to someone who raises their right hand to support and defend the Constitution that you're going to do it and you're going to do it for free.
Also, there's been a steep drop in fertility rates in western U.S. states,
where there has also been a big jump in the cost of housing.
I was kind of like, oh my gosh, my mom was right. this is too expensive.
And on Halloween, a look at the history of the Ouija board. First, this spooktacular newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Two federal judges have ordered the Trump administration to use emergency funds to keep paying food assistance benefits, known as SNAP. It's unclear if the administration will comply with the orders. Just before that ruling, Trump blamed Democrats for the funds running out this weekend amid the federal government shutdown. NPR's Sam Greenglass has more.
The Trump administration has said it cannot use contingency funds for SNAP, even as it's repurposed other funds to pay U.S. troops and others. Aboard Air Force One, Trump said SNAP would be funded if Democrats reopen the government.
I'm president. I want to help everybody. I want to help Democrats and Republicans. But when you're talking about SNAP, if you look, it's largely Democrats. They're hurting their own people.
Just before the rulings, Trump told reporters he's always willing to meet with Democrats. All they have to do is open the country. Trump is not in town this weekend anyway. He'll be attending a Halloween party at Mar-a-Lago tonight. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, West Palm Beach, Florida.
And amid the government shutdown, the White House confirms that military personnel are being paid today. While members of Congress remain deadlocked over reopening the government, the Trump administration is moving money around to selectively fund military pay, but not other programs. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben has more.
An Office of Management and Budget spokesperson confirms reporting originally done by Axios, saying that the agency is using around $5 billion from a military housing fund, a military research and development fund, and a Defense Department account used for building ships. NPR asked if part of the money is also coming from a $130 million donation made by a billionaire Trump ally, but the OMB did not respond. Trump has said he thinks he can cut, quote, Democrat programs during the shutdown but fund others. Tomorrow, funding for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which feeds low-income families, is set to lapse. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
It's been a hard day for air traffic travelers across much of the country. NPR's Joel Rose reports staffing shortages among air traffic controllers who are working without pay contributed to extensive delays.
Much of the nation's airspace was a mess, with a combination of staffing shortages and high winds leading to major delays. The Federal Aviation Administration said staffing shortages contributed to ground delays at a number of airports, including Boston, Nashville, Dallas, Houston, New York, and Newark, New Jersey, while high winds limited operations around New York City and Washington, D.C. That combination made for one of the worst days to fly since the government shutdown began a month ago. Air traffic controllers are required to work without pay until the shutdown ends. They missed their first full paycheck earlier this week. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street higher by the closing bell. The Dow up 40, the Nasdaq up 143, S&P 500 up 17. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The American Academy of Pediatrics says it doesn't recommend the routine use of leucovorin to treat autism in children, citing limited evidence. That guidance comes as pediatricians continue to face questions from parents about a drug touted by President Trump to help treat autism. NPR's Maria Godoy has more.
Leucovorin is a prescription form of vitamin B. It's typically used to reduce the side effects of chemotherapy and to treat a specific kind of anemia. The AAP says the drug has shown some potential benefits in early, small-scale studies for children with cerebral folate deficiency. A minority of people with autism also have this condition. However, the AAP says larger, controlled clinical trials are still needed to determine if the drug is a safe and effective option for the broader autistic population. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
The death toll from what was Hurricane Melissa that barreled through the Caribbean has climbed to at least 46, although officials say they expect that number to rise. Search and rescue efforts are underway as cleanup from the powerful storm begins. Haiti, Cuba, and Jamaica were hard hit, where satellite imagery in Jamaica shows entire villages destroyed by mudslides, flooding, and downed trees. Telecommunication breakdowns are hampering information. Staff from the State Department's Regional Disaster Assistance Program arrived in the Caribbean yesterday to assist in their recovery efforts. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation with Pathbreakers, a podcast about transforming communities through innovation, from revolutionizing higher education to supporting artists who are driving change. Pathbreakers is available on podcast platforms.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information available at mndeerhunters.com. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. Two federal judges today ruled that it is unlawful for the Trump administration to suspend SNAP food benefits tomorrow, but it's still not clear when that food aid will get to the millions of people who rely on it. One judge gave the administration until Monday to come up with a plan. NPR's Jennifer Ludden joins us now. Hi there.
Hi.
So, Jennifer, this dispute over SNAP benefits has really raised the stakes of the shutdown. So can you just start by reminding us what's really at the center of the fight over benefits and what these decisions mean?
Sure. So the Trump administration had said a week ago there was not enough money for November payments of SNAP. That's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And it said it had no legal authority to tap contingency funds for that. Judge Indira Talwani in Boston did not buy that at all. She says the administration must use that money to keep the country's largest anti-hunger program going. And in fact, she said they could also tap a larger amount in customs revenue, though she's leaving it up to the administration to decide if they'll do that. So there are still questions here, but one of the Democrats who brought this challenge, New York Attorney General Letitia James, called it a major victory and said we'll continue our lawsuit.
But what does this mean for people who would normally receive their monthly SNAP benefit tomorrow?
They're not going to get that federal money for now. There will be a lapse in funding, and we really don't know for how long. The Trump administration might offer a timeline on Monday. That's the judge's deadline for the government to say whether it plans to pay only partial benefits using its contingency funds, which do fall short of SNAP's normal monthly budget. The administration has said that calculating partial payments is a logistical nightmare, that it might take weeks. Now, Judge Talwani did acknowledge people will be harmed by this lapse in funding. And she noted it's the first time this has ever happened in the program's 60-year history. But she said it is possible to make people whole retroactively with future payments. And so because of that, she actually rejected the Democratic state's claims that this was irreparable harm.
Got it. Okay. And there's a second judge in a separate case who also found that pausing SNAP was illegal today. What more can you tell us about that case?
That was brought in Rhode Island by eight cities, some nonprofits and business groups. They say ending SNAP payments would harm not only people, but local economies and, you know, businesses that rely on shoppers using SNAP. That judge did issue a temporary restraining order. We'll have to see how both of these play out, whether the Trump administration appeals. I did not get an immediate response from the Agriculture Department, but before the rulings today, President Trump said there's always the possibility of moving funds to cover SNAP benefits, but he said Democrats are the one who need to act.
So then where does this leave states and cities that have been ramping up to try and help to fill the gap of this missing food aid?
That help is certainly still needed for now. Two-thirds of SNAP recipients are seniors, children, or they have a disability. Many do work. Their incomes, though, are very low. You know, local officials are worried about people choosing between food and rent or medication. Some are shifting funds to help fill a gap. They're stepping up food donations or allowing flexibility if people fall behind in their bills. Again, it's just not clear how long this pause is going to last.
Last thing, I mean, we're focused on SNAP benefits because it affects so many people, but are there other safety net programs being hit as the shutdown continues?
Absolutely. Also, as of tomorrow, 65,000 children may lose access to early education through Head Start. There's a different nutrition program called WIC for pregnant women and new parents. That's running out of money or will soon in many places. And heating aid for millions of people is also at risk in November. So some families could be facing, you know, a double or triple whammy.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump is in Florida today. That wouldn't be particularly notable, except there is a government shutdown that is creating more and more real-world consequences, including that impending lapse in SNAP benefits. This is not an isolated trip for the president. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith reports Trump has spent nearly 2 weeks outside of Washington since the shutdown began October 1st.
When President Trump arrived in Malaysia earlier this week, he was greeted by a brass band and dancers. Trump got in on it, too, as described in this color commentary that went out on the White House video feed.
In rare and light-hearted moment, President Donald Trump has joined the Malaysian dancers, moving to the cheerful rhythm of the ensemble.
It was the start of a week-long trip to Asia that included stops in three countries, but it also marked a significant break with how past presidents, including Trump himself, have approached government shutdowns. They have typically avoided the bad optics of skipping town during a crisis. In 1995, President Clinton canceled a trip to Japan during a shutdown. Republicans controlled Congress at the time. Leon Panetta was Clinton's chief of staff.
We spent a number of days in the Oval Office basically negotiating with both Speaker Gingrich and Majority Leader Bob Dole, because the last thing we wanted to do was to have the government shut down.
During the 2013 shutdown, then-President Obama canceled a four-nation Asia trip. And in 2019, President Trump had a trip planned to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland.
If the shutdown continues, I won't go.
The shutdown continued, and he didn't go. That shutdown lasted 35 days, the longest on record. An NPR analysis finds that during that period, Trump only left Washington for 6 days, and there were no visits to his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. This time is quite different. During the month-long shutdown, Trump has gone to Florida twice, golfed at his club in Virginia, and visited the Middle East and Asia. 13 days on the road so far, with more to come. The White House position on negotiating is different now, too. Vice President Vance spoke to the press yesterday.
We are not going to give in on policy demands under the threat of hostage taking.
He said Republicans won't negotiate with Democrats until they vote to reopen the government. The GOP-controlled House of Representatives has been gone all month. The Senate voted 13 times on the same funding bill and failed each time without enough Democratic support. Democrats say they want to negotiate. Doug High was a House Republican aide during the 2013 government shutdown, and he doesn't fault the president for leaving now.
Whether he's going to events in foreign countries or just sort of living life, none of that interferes with what the core argument is, which is Republicans saying, we've done our job, Democrats, step up and do yours. To do anything different would actually cut against their own messaging.
But Leon Panetta, who served in Congress and multiple Democratic administrations, sees it differently.
They're basically walking away from the very responsibility that they should be exercising as elected officials. I mean, that's what's depressing about all of this.
White House spokesperson Anna Kelly defended the president's travel, saying he secured massive investments in the U.S. economy. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Today is Halloween, time to bring out the costumes and candy and maybe the Ouija board. Over the past 150 years or so, this witchy game has been everything from a connection to the dearly departed to a teen rite of passage and the subject of a moral panic. Dina Prishup has this social history.
When Ellie Moxa was growing up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa in the 1980s, she and her friends had a lot of slumber parties. And Ouija boards were a big part of them.
We were Catholic school kids, and we literally thought we were talking to Satan. Like, we were really worried about it.
And the questions they asked were pretty much always the same.
Who am I going to marry? What's my future going to be like? We sort of knew we were pushing the thing ourselves, but we sort of didn't. And it was just scary enough.
Mox's 13-year-old kid, Serene, recently gathered around a Ouija board with his friends here in Portland, Oregon.
So I can feel you pushing it.
I am not the one pushing it. That's
who you are. I can tell.
Yeah, no, it's not me.
These kids asked similar questions, along with some new ones.
Will I ever eat a whole lemon?
That is a question.
Okay, this is a group of teens and tweens. But honestly, I think it's hard for anyone to use a Ouija board without laughing. And maybe freaking themselves out a little. But it started as a pretty serious pursuit. Emily Clark teaches religion at Gonzaga University and is working on a book about the spiritualist movement of the 1800s.
In order to figure out how to communicate with spirits, which was the main focus of spiritualism, well, people got really creative.
We're talking seances, spirits answering questions by knocking from the beyond or writing through a medium. And in the 1870s, they started experimenting with what were called talking boards.
And these are the precursor to what we know as the modern day Ouija board.
Clark says it makes sense that people would be interested in connecting with the spirit world when the Civil War had brought death in such huge numbers. And she says until the turn of the century, you didn't really see much pushback from major Christian denominations to spiritualism in general or the Ouija board in particular.
From its outset, you've got people who believe that this is truly a means of communicating with the dead. You have people who believe this is just fun. Some who believe this is a way to figure out what does my own inner subconscious think about things.
According to Clark, after World War I, interest in the Ouija board exploded in the U.S., throughout the roaring 20s and beyond, it was marketed as a wholesome parlor game. The Saturday Evening Post had a Norman Rockwell cover with a Ouija board. It was a goofy plot point in I Love Lucy. But that image of innocent fun started to shift in the 70s and 80s.
This is around the rise of the first satanic panics when there's this concern of Satanism just rampant across the U.S., and then also, in the early 1970s, a little film called The Exorcist comes out.
Where a little girl gets possessed by a demon invited in because of the Ouija board. But even so, or perhaps because of it, sales of the game continue. And the Ouija board has been cemented as the stuff of slumber parties and goofing around. And occasionally scaring ourselves along the way.
Y'all stop pushing it.
It wasn't me, it was the spirits.
For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchup.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18 on this Halloween afternoon, and you're listening to KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. And it is Member Appreciation Week here at KXE KBXE, and we've got a special Kids Green Cheese airing tomorrow night from 6 to 7 p.m. with Mike Spry and youngsters Mia and Alex. We receive support from the Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. WatermarkArtCenter.org. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is looking for people to collect tree seeds and cones this fall and winter. Current high-demand species include jack pine, black spruce, and red pine. Visit mndnr.gov/seedcone for more information. United Way of 1000 Lakes presents Dining United now through November 20th. Find a list of participating Itasca County restaurants at uwlakes.org. The Brainerd Nordic Ski Club hosts their annual ski swap tomorrow at Forest View Middle School. Equipment drop-off begins at 7:30 a.m. and the sale runs from 9 to noon. Find new and used ski equipment, plus other winter sports gear. The Mesabi Symphony Orchestra kicks off its season Saturday, November 1st at 7 p.m. at Rock Ridge Performing Arts Center in Virginia. Find more info and tickets at MesabiSymphonyOrchestra.org. And don't forget to check out our website, KAXE.org, for the latest area voices, set list, Up North Report, and Bright Spot.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Families around the world are having fewer children as people make different decisions about their lives. That is a story we have been covering all week in NPR's Population Shift series. There's been an especially steep drop in fertility rates in western U.S. states, where communities have also seen a big jump in the cost of housing. The Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Merzbach reports from Wyoming.
A sea of toddlers throw around colorful blocks and balls at an indoor play center in the Wyoming state capital of Cheyenne. 21-year-old Grace Moreno is here with her 11th-month-old, who's dressed in pajamas with little fire trucks on them.
It's the only free place, so it's worth it.
Finances are tight for Moreno and her husband. They moved here from Texas while pregnant so her husband could work a higher-paying electrician job. But now with their baby boy, paychecks seem to disappear.
Our rent in Texas was like $800. Here it's like $1,775.
Rent is their biggest cost. Then $300 a week on groceries, $100 on formula, car payments, and paying for their son's delivery.
I remember sitting there looking at like a stack of mail, probably like maybe 3 inches tall, hospital bills, ER bills. I looked at my husband, I was like, I don't ever want to do this again.
Just 6 weeks after giving birth, Moreno decided to get her tubes tied. She once thought she'd have multiple kids.
I was kind of like, oh my gosh, my mom was right. this is too expensive.
Only having one kid means Moreno's family can save a couple $100 a month for a mortgage, so their son can someday have a backyard. At the moment, though, interest rates are still relatively high.
Like, it's not only are homes more expensive, but then add, you know, a 7% rate on top of that.
Emily Harris, a demographer at the University of Utah, says Wyoming's fertility rate is just above the national average, but still too low to replace the state's population. But like many Western states, Wyoming's population is growing. Lots of people are moving to the region to escape bigger cities and for an outdoorsy quality of life, which is driving up home costs. Harris says things like childcare costs and generational values also play into people's childbearing decisions, and that they're definitely changing.
We have this idea of like the nuclear family, and you know, you need to get married, and then you buy a home, and then you have children. And really, over the last decade or two, that kind of timeline has been halted and kind of rearranged.
Some states are passing laws aimed at easing housing costs for young families, but not Wyoming. Trey Sherwood is a Democratic state lawmaker here.
The biggest barrier to addressing this housing crisis is really convincing my colleagues that the government has a role to play.
Progressives have pushed for a state fund to help build more affordable housing. The Republican supermajority says that would just gum up the wheels of the free market. They say bills they passed to restrict abortion access, allow nannies to care for more children, and ease property taxes are family-friendly policies. But Wyoming couples like Reese Lane and Sean Thornton say it's just too expensive to have kids now.
Sean and I started dating, and he said, I don't know, I think I want to have like 6 or 7 kids.
But as we went through like more and more financial struggles, I guess, eventually it came to like, yeah, I think we can have like 1 or 2.
The state university employees spent their 20s struggling to pay rent in tiny apartments. At age 30, they finally bought this house.
I think that's when we started to realize it might be too late. I'm not sure that we're going to be able to have children.
Lane says it's heartbreaking to not have enough money to give even one kid a full life, but also freeing. For now, they're focused on their fur babies, a Pomeranian and a Shih Tzu mix, who are dressed in matching bandanas with fall leaves.
They're 100% little babies. They're so spoiled.
For NPR News, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Laramie, Wyoming.
The federal food assistance benefits of more than 40 million people are uncertain after a pair of federal rulings Friday. Louisiana is tied with Oregon for the second highest per capita SNAP recipient rate in the country. There, the Republican-controlled legislature created its own food assistance program from its rainy day fund in case SNAP benefits stalled. But as member station WRKF's Brooke Thorington reports from Baton Rouge, not everyone will see those funds next month.
Louisiana's Republican Governor Jeff Landry says the state is acting with compassion and reason in the face of the federal government shutdown and the lapse of funding for SNAP.
When you're not fiscally responsible, when you don't understand how to ensure that you have money for a rainy day, then you can't act when it rains.
While some states are offering assistance by sending funds to local food banks, Louisiana will prop up SNAP for the month of November using $150 million from the state's $2.7 billion rainy day fund. Recipients will receive that directly on their benefit cards. As he announced the stopgap funding, Landry didn't miss an opportunity to place the blame on Democrats in Washington.
Understand that what we're doing is historic. It has never been done. We've never had to be placed in this situation. And any mistake that we make is Chuck Schumer's fault.
Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer says he'll support short-term bills to fund SNAP proposed by both parties. But in Louisiana's short-term funding measure, there's a catch. Only SNAP beneficiaries who are elderly, disabled, or have children in the home will receive funds for November. Landry says in an interview on a local TV station that others will be excluded.
But there's going to be about 53,000 people who won't have their cards loaded. Those are able-bodied people that we need to send to food banks.
Leaving some recipients without those benefits is a restrictive approach to the program, but Louisiana is still an outlier in the Southeast when it comes to filling the gap for food assistance. Residents of southern states like Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, and Mississippi will go without any government food assistance for now. Louisiana is among the first states to announce it's using state funds towards SNAP. Many food banks, including those in Louisiana, called upon by the governor to step in, are already facing shortages.
The food banks are critically low on inventory. We've already been assisting lots of federal workers who are working without pay.
Jane Wright-Velez is the executive director of the Food Bank of Central Louisiana.
For every meal that we provide, SNAP provides 9. And so that's just an illustration of scale for you.
Lawmakers approved the emergency funding in a near unanimous vote this week. State Senate President Cameron Henry says that widespread support across party lines shows how SNAP benefits are received by a broad cross-section of the state.
So that our friends in D.C. can appreciate what we're doing, those individuals are not all white or black, and they're not all Republican or Democrat. And how do I know that? Because look at who they elected. Regina Barrow has 29,000.
He lists state lawmakers from both parties with thousands of SNAP recipients in each of their districts.
So you're trying to put D's and R's on this, ain't going to work. Because their representatives show you that.
And while the country awaits the shutdown to end, Henry says the state will continue to meet the needs of the most vulnerable SNAP recipients.
Until D.C. gets organized, straight, sane, whatever you want to call it. Their problems have now become ours. That's fine. That's why we're elected and we'll fix them.
For NPR, I'm Brooke Thorington in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. The Arrowhead Library System hosts local author Susan Hawkinson with tales of lumberjacks, settlers, and lumber barons now through November 14th. Find a full schedule at alslib.info. Now it's time for the Up North Report here on KAXE KBXE.
Oh.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. The Minnesota Star Tribune has confirmed that Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested 8 unauthorized immigrants in Hibbing on Wednesday. In a news release, the St. Louis County Sheriff's Office said the arrest came during a drug-related search warrant. The Sheriff's Office says in September, an undercover officer bought cocaine from someone who lived and worked at the location on the 1800 block of 3rd Avenue East, which is La Tequila Taco Shop. A man was arrested on suspicion of third-degree sale of cocaine and possession of a firearm by an ineligible person. The man also had several fake identification documents, according to the Sheriff's Office. The release further stated that the Sheriff's Office was aware that federal law enforcement, quote, took additional actions during the search warrant, but did not provide any more information. Authorities at the scene included the Hibbing Police Department, U.S. Border Patrol, Drug Enforcement Administration, Enforcement and Removal Operations, and Homeland Security Investigations. Federal agents were also seen at another Mexican restaurant, El Charro Mexican Bar and Grill. Governor Tim Walz's announcement of a pause in payments for 14 Medicaid programs in Minnesota caused widespread confusion and anxiety among people who provide services to the elderly and disabled. The Walz administration announced Wednesday that the governor ordered a, quote, pause on all payments for 14 DHS Medicaid services until an audit is complete. The Minnesota Reformer reports that providers and Democratic legislators reacted with alarm, given the prospect of unpaid caregivers and vulnerable Minnesotans shut out of life-saving services. The Department of Human Services clarified that each payment will undergo a review and only be paused for up to 90 days if, quote, an anomaly is detected and needs to be reviewed further. If the review determines the bill is fraudulent, it will not be paid. The snafu comes as Walz seeks to get ahead of the fraudsters who have bilked state and federal programs out of hundreds of millions of dollars in recent years, as well as Republican attacks on the fraud issue, which are already incoming as Walz begins a race for a third four-year term. A DHS statement to providers on Wednesday stated that there still may be payment processing delays, but the payments pause is not as all-encompassing as providers feared from the news release. The governor's office defended the language of the release to the Minnesota Reformer. Health coverage affordability is top of mind for many Minnesotans. Officials with the state's insurance marketplace say it's reasonable to be worried about what lies ahead, but trusted navigators can still potentially find savings and help avoid pitfalls. November 1st is the enrollment start date for people who get their coverage through MNsure, which is Minnesota's insurance exchange through the Affordable Care Act. Enhanced federal subsidies that keep costs lower expire at year's end as that debate plays out in Congress. MNsure's Mary Robinson says whether it's the larger tax credits or changes to insurance plans, people should look into their options as soon as possible.
Even if you've been in the same plan for years, don't just hit repeat. There may be a better fit for your needs and your budget.
If the tax credits expire, some 19,000 MNsure enrollees will lose all financial help. But nearly 70,000 still may qualify for subsidies, albeit at a reduced level. So Robinson says it's important to not immediately think the worst and connect with a local trusted broker or navigator by searching MNsure's directory. She says the free guidance will steer you in the right direction and avoid scammers or online influencers promoting too-good-to-be-true plans and premiums. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. A new nonprofit aimed at strengthening the vitality of downtown Grand Rapids is beginning a branding process. In a news release, the Grand Rapids Downtown Alliance says it will serve as a connector for those who share a vision for a thriving, welcoming downtown. The planning and development for the alliance is being fully funded with a startup grant from the Blandin Foundation. The branding effort will culminate in a new visual identity and messaging strategy to guide future marketing, programming, and investment efforts. The organization is also hiring an executive director. Amid one of the longest government shutdowns in U.S. history, causing disruptions to food support, our news team put together a list of food-related resources across the region. Find it on our homepage at kaxe.org. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The Trump administration says it is paying federal troops today, but that does not fully end the shutdown confusion for these military members. For the National Guard, there are added complications. WUNC's Jay Price reports.
Some National Guard troops on full-time active duty have continued to collect paychecks during the shutdown, but most have not. Those going without pay include the majority of Guard members who serve part-time, typically one weekend a month and 2 weeks a year. And it also includes more than 33,000 dual-status technicians who work full-time in uniform for the Guard but are considered government civilian workers. Those technicians haven't seen a paycheck since the end of September, but most still have to work because they perform vital jobs like keeping supplies moving, maintaining aircraft, and running the Guard's electronic systems.
You've got that big emotional effect now across our families. You know, that's active and reserve.
John Hashem is a retired Army two-star general who leads the Reserve Organization of America, an advocacy group for Guard and Reserve troops and families.
And it's a disservice to someone who, you know, raises their right hand to support and defend the Constitution that you're going to do it and you're going to do it for free now.
Hashem's group and others are lobbying Congress to pay all troops and the technicians during the shutdown. Meanwhile, the families are scrambling. Like many hit by the shutdown, they're visiting food pantries, and a few have even started GoFundMe appeals.
Is anything they can do to guarantee they can put food on the table? Borrowing money from other family members? Taking loans out, selling cars. Those are some of the things that I've heard right off the bat.
Hashem says he's heard of at least one case in which a family had to stop paying for health insurance. Jenny Aiken, a vice president of Blue Star Families, an advocacy and support group for military families, is hearing similar stories.
One of them in particular, I'm going to see if I can talk about this without choking up. You know, they have one car, and that car needs to be used by a person who is going to a job every day. And the other, you know, the spouse who's at home can't even get to the food pantry, you know, to get the food because it is all running out faster now because everybody's using it. So, you know, our Guard and Reserve are just as deployed and often more so than our active duty forces. They are paramount to our national security, and we have to start thinking of them that way.
The Trump administration's controversial deployments of units to American cities has added to the demands on the National Guard. Traditionally, of course, a big Guard role is helping with disaster recovery and other emergency needs at the state level. Jocelyn Mitnall-Millett is the Secretary of Military and Veterans Affairs for North Carolina, where most of the more than 10,000 Guardsmen aren't getting their weekend training or pay. She notes that among those not getting checks are 841 of the dual status technicians who work full time with the Guard. And those technicians are having trouble getting parts they need for tasks like helicopter maintenance because of supply chain problems related to the shutdown.
And it's getting to the point where the National Guard's ability to perform missions and execute missions at the federal level will be compromised pretty quickly.
Aiken, with Blue Star Families, is eager for the shutdown to end. And now that government shutdowns have become regular occurrences, she hopes something good comes out of the chaos.
You know, every hard time is an opportunity to improve. And I think this has given us the opportunity to see some very acute pain points that we as a nation need to fix and address because it's critical to our national security.
But meanwhile, she says she just got an email from one of the people whose role in the government is to help military families in need. That person expects to be furloughed soon. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Durham, North Carolina.
This Halloween, some kids will go door to door to collect money for children in need abroad. Trick or Treat for UNICEF turns 75 this year against the backdrop of vast federal cuts to foreign aid. Reporter Ari Daniel has our story.
On Zoom.
This is my mother and father.
Monroe Allison holds up a black and white photo of his mom, Mary Emma, and his dad, Clyde, a pastor. The couple believed in the power of community service, and in the late 40s, amidst the food shortages and famines that World War II had caused in Europe and parts of Asia, Allison's mom saw well-fed American kids trick-or-treating and had an idea.
These kids could be doing something really meaningful instead of just collecting candy for themselves. So it was my mother who demanded of my father, we have to convert this into something good.
The Halloween collections were born, with Sunday school children gathering shoes, soap, and coins for kids in need abroad. Diane Allison is Monroe's wife.
Oh, it's vitally important because of that experience of empathy for other children, the power to do something.
The Allisons soon recognized that UNICEF was an ideal charity to partner with, and by 1951, Diane says the agency had transformed the nascent idea into a national campaign of collecting spare change. Public service announcements aired on TV.
Won't you help the children help the children?
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Montgomery.
Hi, my name is Sammy Davis Jr. Would you believe that a whole generation...
That was Lassie barking, by the way. Since its inception 75 years ago, the program has raised some $200 million. Monroe Allison again.
And the children who participated in it, and that's my parents' idea, get as much out of this as the people receiving it.
People like Minyoung Kerr. He's one of the so-called lost boys of Sudan who fled their homes in the early 90s due to civil war. Kerr landed in a refugee camp in Ethiopia where he lived for 13 years. Kerr remembers UNICEF providing him and the other kids with food and school supplies, items he was told that came from American children.
He's very excited to see a kid helping kids, children helping one another.
Kerr credits those gifts with helping him get critical calories as a boy and an education.
Hope, that's what it meant for me at the time.
Trick or Treat for UNICEF began a decade before USAID was established. Now it appears to have outlasted the Foreign Aid Agency, which the Trump administration has dismantled. Charles Kenny is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development think tank.
This program has been running for 75 years for a reason, right? It's that a lot of Americans really do care, despite what's going on in Washington.
The U.S. is still the largest foreign aid donor worldwide in absolute dollars, but need far outweighs that support. Kenny says this is where the UNICEF program can play a role.
It provides some of the financing and some of the awareness, and we need both.
This year's collection takes place amidst a dramatic and abrupt scaling back of U.S. foreign aid.
There's so much hopelessness with all these cuts. And this is something that stands against that.
Beverly Weiler is 75, and she's been trick-or-treating for UNICEF since she was little. On Halloween, she and her Quaker friends put out a table in her Santa Fe neighborhood with more information, along with dolls and pumpkin soup. She says the needs of the world are more visible than ever, and this campaign offers an antidote.
It gives children somewhere to lay down their worries a little and make sense in a world that often doesn't make sense.
For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. More than 12,000 public health leaders and researchers are kicking off a meeting this weekend in Washington, D.C. to face what they see as a crisis in their field.
I think public health is under attack by our own federal government more than anything else.
They're coming together to discuss how to counter what they see as dangerous ideas coming from the Make America Healthy Again movement. NPR's Ping Wong has this report on what's at stake.
Dr. Georges Benjamin has led the American Public Health Association for almost 25 years, and he's very worried about how the Trump administration has cut staff and funding for public health.
They're undermining the core systems that we have for people to get good, solid medical care in our country.
Benjamin says White House policies are also interrupting the pipeline for doctors and nurses and making it harder to import drugs and new technologies.
They are totally destroying the modern health system as we know today.
So the American Public Health Association is meeting this upcoming week to defend their vision for America's health. They're up against forces like the Make America Healthy Again movement, led by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Mark Gorton is co-president of the Maha Institute think tank, which aims to influence federal policies and launched earlier this year. He says what they're about is
cleaning up the corruption in the health system, restoring the integrity of the public health and medical systems.
And he wants to see some of the existing systems go away.
It's not that I am saying we should utterly destroy public health, but we need to recenter it around truth.
In his opinion, the U.S. health system is, quote, a fear machine to market pharmaceutical products.
Is it your perspective, actually, that, like, you know, if we stopped fluoridating water, stopped vaccinating people, just as two examples, like, everyone would be fine and better off?
Yes. We would have a healthier population without those things.
Gorton is not a medical doctor. He's the founder of the tech company LimeWire. He also started a hedge fund, and he's been a big supporter of Secretary Kennedy, or Bobby, as he calls him, for years. Dr. Benjamin, again, with the American Public Health Association, says Gorton's critique of public health is misinformed.
And the reason that most of us are alive long enough to be able to complain about public health is because of public health.
He notes that public health has saved millions of people from early deaths through sanitation, vaccination, and discouraging unhealthy behaviors like smoking. Dr. Carmen Navarez is a longtime public health leader. She sees the MAHA movement as a reaction.
MAHA doesn't come out of nowhere. You know, it comes out of people's lived realities. It comes out of circumstances where they felt that something was not addressed correctly.
Healthcare costs are high in this country. The COVID pandemic years were hard and isolating for many people. She hears the criticism and hopes to find common ground, but it's a challenge, she says, because there is a key difference in the public health approach.
There's times when you have to say, sorry, you're not just a danger to yourself, you're a danger to others. And that's why we are going to limit your freedom.
Like forcing someone with tuberculosis to get treated so they don't infect others, or shutting a restaurant with an active rat problem.
If you live alone in an island, this is not your problem. If you live with neighbors and people in a city with you, it's your problem.
At the coming meeting, public health leaders will rally for their own vision for protecting America's health. Ping Huang, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingel. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. The Itasca Curling Club in Grand Rapids offers nightly Learn to Curl sessions November 3rd through the 7th. Drop in from 6 to 7:30 any evening to learn the sport of curling. Bring clean sneakers and wear comfortable clothes. We receive support from Harmony Food Co-op in Bemidji, partnering with local farms for over two decades to provide fresh and local foods, promoting sustainability through local buying. Open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. Adventures in Lifelong Learning continues its fall season every Tuesday at 10 a.m. at the Bemidji Eagles Club. Coffee and treats are served beginning at 9:40. There will be a variety of speakers each week. Find a full schedule on Facebook. Look for Bemidji Adventures in Lifelong Learning. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses, including cloud solutions, cybersecurity services, network management, and more, all with local customer service and support. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. Central Lakes College invites the community to its next Cultural Thursday event at noon on November 6th at the Chalberg Theater on the Brainerd campus. Author and social worker Julie Jo Larson will highlight the power of storytelling to strengthen communities. Cohasset Parks and Rec offers a full moon hike Tuesday, November 4th. Meet at the Clay Boswell Boat Landing at 7:30. Bring a headlamp and wear sturdy shoes. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Florence Welch, who fronts the band Florence and the Machine, has always felt a kind of transcendent freedom when she's performing, a freedom that she didn't always feel offstage.
I've always felt that, you know, I was uncomfortable in my skin as a kid. I was uncomfortable in my physical body as a teenager, and then I would step on stage and it was always like, I am free from the body. I am free from the chattering in my head. I am free from the kind of expectations of me off stage. Here, I can kind of be anything. It's
Welch, who's back with a new album called Everybody Scream, has always given so much physically to the stage. Like, she'll run and jump around barefoot. She's broken bones on stage multiple times, but still, she continues to perform, even while bleeding. So when I sat down with her recently, I was like, what is it inside you when you're on stage that just takes over and makes you keep going?
It's strange. I'm a sort of vulnerable person in lots of ways. Like, I'm really open and sensitive, and yet there is this, like, part of me that is so tough when it comes to performance, and it is that something takes over my physical body.
Yeah.
That is almost, like, inhuman, you know, and it can do inhuman feats, and I feel like the stage, I'm allowed to let this beast of energy out, and then it just does whatever the wants.
I love that. I mean, I can hear the beast when I'm listening to that song, Everybody Scream.
Get on stage, and I call her by her first name. Try to stay away, but I always meet her back at this place. She gives me everything, I feel no pain. I break down, get up, and do it all again. Because it's never enough, and she makes me feel loved. I can come here and scream as loud as I want.
Your previous album, Dance Fever, was partly inspired by an actual 16th century phenomenon where people, women, dance themselves to death.
Yes.
Well, you know, coincidentally, you almost died on this tour in 2023, right? Can you tell us what happened?
I know, it's like this. I have spoken about for a while, like, the kind of strange prescient nature of songwriting, and, you know, I had been writing songs about motherhood, like King, and there was especially a line in it that was debating and defying whether motherhood was for me, and there was a line that was like, I never knew my killer would be coming from within.
I never knew my killer would be coming from within.
And then I actually went on to have a life-threatening ectopic miscarriage on stage in the last month of the Dance Fever tour.
And just so people understand, an ectopic pregnancy is when the fertilized egg, like, implants outside the uterus, like in someone's fallopian tube.
Yeah, it gets trapped, and I needed emergency surgery because I was bleeding internally, and 48 hours later, I don't really know what would have happened to me.
Perfume and milk, the body in bloom, the falling leaves, the fallen fruit.
Well, may I ask, have you gotten to a point where you are ready to try to get pregnant again?
Well, like, I spoke to someone who specializes in that kind of trauma, and she said the one bit of advice I would give to you is people try and fix it by trying again really fast, you know, like that there's a sense that they can fix what happened.
Right.
And she was like, what I would say from my experience is, you know, only try again when you feel like yourself, when you feel like yourself again. And I think part of putting this record together and doing a tour is because it is the place that I feel the most myself. There is a song called Perfume and Milk, which was kind of thinking about this. There's a line that's like, healing is slow, it comes and it goes, a glimpse of the sun, then a flurry of snow.
The first screen shoots in a sudden frost. Oh, something's gained and something's lost.
Sometimes, you know, I feel very solid. I think I felt much more solid until I started talking about it.
Sorry. And I'm making
it's fine. This is, you know, it's like, I think probably other people feel this way too. I thought like telling people would be this feeling of like, oh, now I understand what happened to me. You know what I mean? It would be like, okay, it all makes sense now. And that didn't really happen. And I was like, okay, I don't think this bit is for me yet. I think this part of it is for anyone out there who also experienced something like this. Mm-hmm. I can't see them. I'm not with them. But someone out there feels held or feels connected because I'm talking about something that they also experienced.
Sit in salt water, call in a vision of my daughter, light a candle.
Well, as you were healing, I saw that you posted on Instagram, quote, creativity is a way of coping. Mythology is a way of making sense. Can you talk more about that? Like, how did mythology help you make sense of what happened? Like, how much did mythology or mysticism play a role in making this new album as you were healing?
It really kind of was a way, I think, to make sense of it. I think what happened to me was so kind of clinical and brutal. Like, modern medicine, like, absolutely saved my life. But it kind of, what I needed was the softness of finding other forms of power, of like natural herbs, like other ways of healing. I needed so much nature around me. There was like a very primal feeling of just needing to like be in the earth. So I think when I was looking into the themes of like witchcraft and magic and medicine, it was almost like a need to find something like some kind of like power within nature.
When you do return to the stage for the music on this new album, what is it that you look forward to the most? What is the thing you want to tap into when you're performing this music?
So I feel like I can let how big the feelings are out. You know, like if I feel deranged, which sometimes I often do, like, and if I feel like I want to scream, but I can't, or I want to weep, but I can't, or just to move my body, like, violently almost to get something out of me. Like, that is my favorite thing about songs, is they hold so many different things at once, and that's my favorite thing about performance, you know? It is endless.
Florence Welch's new album is called Everybody Scream. Thank you so much for speaking with us. It was such a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Arm, on the latest episode of Tech Unheard, Arm CEO and host Rene Haas talks to Minister Ashwini Vaishna of India about how tech and AI are helping to shape the future of computing. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZQIL, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQIL.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the return of their espresso porter, filled with roasted coffee flavor. Now on tap and in cans throughout the region. Bemidji beer, nice catch. Weather tonight, chance of rain or flurries, mostly cloudy with lows 27 to 32 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny, highs near 42, light north wind, overnight lows around 30. And Sunday, mostly cloudy with highs in the upper 40s, low 50s.